The justice system seems more like the injustice system. When everything is a crime, everyone is a criminal. The system seems mostly broken as is, and the division is the state versus the people. My guest today discusses some of the big issues he sees that are broken. Solutions are more complicated than identifying the problems, but it seems worth asking the questions. Can the system or systems be made right? Are billionaires taking control of the prosecution and court system? Are police officers just the enforcement branch of the courts? The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 243, Food and Freedom Once a Week for Life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the podcast. John Odermatt is my guest today. John is a producer and host on the Lions of Liberty podcast network, which he and Brian McWilliams founded in 2012. That's a long time in the podcast world. John hosted Felony Friday, a podcast that reported on the deep systemic problems within the criminal justice system. During the show's seven-year run, John interviewed hundreds of released felons, academics, activists, DNA professionals, law enforcement officers, and other professionals in the criminal justice system in an effort to show the flaws of the system and advocate for reform. John's current show, Finding Freedom, is also on the Lions of Liberty Network. Hello, John. Thank you for joining me on the Eating Liberty Podcast.
Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to this.
Me too. We're going to go over, this is actually something I've only talked about lately, and that is, I'm going to call it the injustice system. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a guy, Bob Smiley, about the jury nullification. And mm-hmm. And so that's an important aspect to this. But you have, on a previous podcast of yours, a different experience to talk about. So before we get to that part, just a quick little bio about who you are, and let's kind of get into the injustice system.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a part of a podcast network called Lions of Liberty, and we've been around for years and years. So I lose track. I think we started our blog back in 2012, and then we started a podcast a couple of years later. And, my first podcast was a spinoff of our flagship Lions of Liberty podcast, and it was called Felony Friday. And, you know, we can get into the story of why, you know, really I started focusing on the criminal justice system. But, you know, essentially I had, you know, a close-up encounter, not me personally, but seeing someone close to our family go through the system. And really, you know, for just a nonviolent crime for selling some marijuana on a not even on a college campus, for in a college apartment, and having a undercover police officer come back multiple times doing undercover buys until they got it up to the amount where they were able to charge with a felony, and seeing that happen. And he probably didn't have the best legal representation, as a lot of the other people who were involved with it ended up getting plea deals of some kind, but he ended up doing some time in jail and then ultimately in a halfway house. And the big takeaway for me was seeing just a small thing like that, the impact it had on his life. And if, you know, his family wasn't there to help him pick up the pieces and, you know, drive him around to, you know, when he was in the halfway house to his job and everything, probably would have fallen right back in back into the system, which happens to most people. So that was one of the driving forces behind me starting Felony Friday. Is just I wanted to talk about a lot of this injustice. I really didn't go into it with the idea that I wanted to interview, you know, all of these people who'd been through the system. I just kind of honestly fell into that. And as I started to build up a network of criminal justice advocates, I just kept getting people referred to me and stories referred to me. And I've, you know, most of the people I've interviewed are for nonviolent crimes, but I have interviewed murderers. You know, I have interviewed people who are sitting on death row. That was a really fascinating series of interviews I did. That was during the pandemic. Probably 2020 is when I did that. And literally I had like a 30-minute chunk of time, and I had someone who was actually writing a book with these three, was it three or four? I can't remember how many people I interviewed in that series, but was writing a book with them. And she was, you know, I would call her, then she would call the jail and they would patch me through. And we had to split it up in two chunks because they could only talk for a certain amount of time. And then you'd get interrupted saying, we have to hang up the call, blah, blah, blah. But it was, those were some crazy interviews.
The logistics of getting that to happen, they're kind of interesting. And since we are in a time budget, I'm not going to pursue that, but that is interesting. So there's a few ways to pursue this, but I think one of the things I want to just start with is, can you think of up to five examples, system-wide, not person-wide, of how the justice system is broken?
Yeah. Off the top of my head, hard to remember. I've written articles about this before. Seven ways the criminal justice system is broken. I'll see if I can remember. So, I mean, one way I think that is a pretty, it's not an easy fix, but it is something that I think is a no-brainer, is we have to reform these drug laws that we have. And I say it's not an easy fix. I say there is some nuance there, because it's not like, you know, just turning a switch on and off. There's already been a lot of damage done, obviously. All right. There's been a secondary black market that's been created, that people are, you know, utilizing in order to feed their families. So for example, just take something like marijuana, where say if we decriminalized it entirely, and I say decriminalized rather than legalized, because I think that's a more fair way to go about it. But yeah, but say we decriminalized marijuana federally, tomorrow, that would be outstanding. Of course, I'd be for that. You're taking a nonviolent crime off the books. But at the same time, there's going to take some time for people to adapt. And of course, unfortunately, we're in a situation where even if that were to happen, probably and we've seen it happen, you know, in the states that have legalized recreationally and medically, it's, you know, corporations and people with connections who are able to come in and scoop up the market, rather than just normal people. You know, if we were just having consensual transactions with each other. So I think there's got to be some way to change the drug laws. I think when it comes to policing, now this is a no-brainer. I mean, you got to get rid of no-knock raids across the board. It's, you know, we had those couple cases a few years ago with Breonna Taylor, who was shot and killed in Kentucky with essentially a stray bullet during a no-knock raid. It's so crazy. There's so many cases of, you know, just thinking back to ones that I've talked about in the past of, you know, flashbang grenades being thrown through windows and landing in babies' cribs during no-knock raids, just horrifying things. And you think back, you know, as we're civilized people, supposedly, right? And this is really the best we can do. You know, even if there is, you know, some, in most cases, it's not a violent criminal. In most cases, they are pursuing, you know, some sort of, you know, nonviolent criminal that should not have this level of urgency to it. But this show is put on, this show of force. And I think a lot of it just is that. It's a show of force. It's the way to, we have these resources, let's use them. So, you know, I think that's two clear ones. Another one, you know, police officers having immunity, I think is another one that we have to take a close look at. I think, you know, one that people talk about often is private prisons. You know, there shouldn't be any private prisons. And I don't think that one is as clear cut. I think the number of private prisons is lower than a lot of people, or percentage of private prisons is lower than a lot of people realize. I think more than anything, we just need less laws. We just have too many laws. And you know, this goes from drug laws to you know, all kinds of other nonviolent laws, or the conspiracy laws, that really a lot of people that end up in prison for drugs for long periods of time, it's not because of possession, or it's normally for conspiracy to commit the crimes, or conspiracy to be acting as a kingpin in an organization. And that's how they get people locked up for 10, 20, 30 years in these drug crimes, when a lot of the time they don't have anything on them, literally nothing, maybe some hearsay testimony. And in the hearsay testimony, maybe they talk about such and such amount of dope, such, you know, when I say dope, I mean, whatever the drug is, weed or cocaine or whatever it is. And that's referred to in these crimes as ghost dope. You know, it's something that's referred to in testimony. And just because it's brought up, they utilize that amount. And that's what informs the charges. That's what informs the conviction. But it's not like it's a tangible amount that was confiscated or anything like that. It's just ghost dope out of thin air. But that's a couple for you.
Fiat dope with the fiat currency. Funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. That particular thing is kind of amusing, although it's not very funny at all. What is the argument against private prisons?
The argument against private prisons. I think it's. I mean, number one, it's just there's been many cases of blatant corruption. You know, uncovered. Where judges are getting paid. There was, and I don't have it in front of me, but several years ago in Pennsylvania, which is where I am, there were judges in central Pennsylvania who it was uncovered that they were taking kickbacks in order to funnel people into these private prisons. So there's a financial incentive there, as you know, the more prisoners you have in the prison, the more profitable it's going to be. And, you know, as a libertarian, it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a tricky question, right? Because we want to privatize everything. We want to privatize policing, right? We want to privatize our prison system, or do we? I think it's kind of tricky because, you know, I as we learn, you know, just because something is a corporation, just because something is private, doesn't necessarily mean that it's good. Often a lot of these, in this case, private prisons or corporations that are so entangled and entwined with a government organization, in this example, you know, a prison system, just become arms of that, you know, that tentacle of the state. So I think the biggest argument is just the corruption that it creates. And through that corruption, people get hurt. People get sent to prison, families get destroyed. So I think that's the argument against private prisons. You know, I think the argument for private prisons would have to include an argument for a private policing system and an argument for a private criminal justice system, which honestly is a conversation that is it's a long one to have to sort all of that out. And I don't even know if it's worth having at this point because it's never going to happen. So that's where I am on that.
Your cynicism is probably right, although for those making the argument against private prisons because there's corruption, it seems to me that the people in favor of the government prisons are completely out of touch that corruption could even exist. Oh, well, it's a government. It could never be. It's a monopoly, but it's a good monopoly because I prefer it over the other thing. Well, that's not really an argument. I don't actually know anything about this, although I have a feeling if you're going to be in charge of something like putting people in behind bars, in cages, there has to be more than a few creative ways to be corrupt in that system. And I don't think the government is excluded from being corrupt. And the people who didn't fall on the floor listening to this are going to say, yeah, there's lots of ways that's the case. I think the knee-jerk reaction is that private prisons cause corruption, so get rid of the private prisons. Well, hey, stop a minute. And I think you're right that at least the word we just have some common sense reform for this other thing. And so it's kind of a joke. Reform is a weird thing, and I've gotten to the point, my cynicism is that reform is just a way to get more cash from tax dollars to not actually accomplish anything except to determine we need more cash to come to a better answer. But it's a conversation worth having, probably not today, about how would the justice system, which maybe in my sort of juvenile thinking includes the criminal, the enforcement arm, how can that be reformed to be made better? And that leads me to this next question. Was it ever intended to function correctly?
Well, I think that's a fair question. And, you know, I don't like correctly. It's kind of a tough question to answer because so correctly in whose eyes, right?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. And as I what I wrote was it intended to function? I added it correctly. Yeah. So, but functioning badly, so it functions. The car that misses, the 8-cylinder car that hits on 5 cylinders still functions. You're not going to race anybody in the Petty family with it, but you can get from point A to point B. So maybe I mean efficiently. Maybe that's the word I mean.
I would say I don't think it was. I mean, you look at like I don't know if you're familiar with it, with Harry Anslinger, who essentially is the father of the war on drugs. And great book written by Johan Hari called Chasing the Scream. Great audiobook. If you don't want to read it, listen to the audiobook. One of the best audiobooks I've ever listened to. And what he did is at the beginning, he does talk about Harry Anslinger and this origin of the war on drugs. And he also then goes through and talks, you know, writes about a lot of these different individuals' stories through drug addiction and what's led to it. And, you know, essentially what led Harry Anslinger to creating this war on drugs was his personal experiences with, I believe it was his mother, having severe drug addiction. So if you look at someone like Harry Anslinger, in his eyes, the goal, you know, being effective, the system was ending drug addiction in any way possible. And the way he was going to do it by getting rid of drugs, prohibiting them, you know, and the same, you know, the same thing went into prohibition, you know, alcohol prohibition. They just thought they could take alcohol, you know, off the streets so people couldn't get it, and that would solve the problem. Of course, we've seen with any prohibition, it just doesn't work. Just because, you know, if there is a demand for a product, if there's, you know, consumers who want to use the product, good or bad. And I'm not even saying that people should. I mean, people should not be using drugs. People should not be using meth or crack or heroin or whatever. It's terrible stuff. It's going to ruin your life. Even marijuana can ruin people's lives. If you're smoking it, you know, every day and you're not going to work and you're lazy and you're sitting on the couch, yeah, it's going to ruin your life. So, that's not to say it should be prohibited, because we see all of these other secondary correlated, risks essentially that trigger because of the prohibition. And, you know, prohibition leads to violence. I mean, that's not only just something that is, as you think through it rationally, it makes sense, but we have a history of it. I mean, we look back at prohibition and all of the alcohol prohibition, all of the violence that it caused. We look at drug prohibition right now, all of the violence that it's causing. And then we look today, modern day, at a liquor store. You walk into a liquor store, there's nothing violent happening. You buy a fifth of tequila, there's nothing violent. You go to your car and you leave. Or you walk into a pharmacy and you buy whatever antibiotics you need, or cold medicine, things that are legal, and there's no shootout happening. So the violence occurs where the prohibition is, where the market is able to operate, even though it's a heavily manipulated market. And, you know, in many cases, like in Pennsylvania, where I am, the government controls much of the alcohol sales. It still has enough of an aspect of freedom that the violence does not creep in. And the reason violence does creep in to heavily prohibited markets is because there is no, there's no opportunity for arbitration. There's no legal opportunity to go to a court to settle a dispute. If there's a dispute between two drug dealers over the turf that they're working on, they can't go to a judge and say, "Hey, I've had a claim to this property and, you know, sales here for this amount of time, and I've sold this much amount, and this is my market." And it's not possible. So what happens? The only way to work this out is through violence. That's really the only possible end game. So that's what it ends up leading to. And unfortunately, the response that we've seen to the violence is more violence. We've seen a militarized police force that has responded to it. We talked about no-knock raids earlier. I mean, you asked for some other examples. Demilitarizing the police. Say demilitarizing the police five times fast. Like, it's, you can't say it. It's a tough one to say. But I mean, it's crazy. I mean, when you already have a war going on the streets and you introduce another element of war, being militarized police, of course things are going to escalate. And unfortunately, that's what we've seen happen in our inner cities, which is just a real shame.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the reformed drug law part, and a clever yet I think very important distinction between decriminalize versus legalize. Now, cannabis, marijuana. I think that was Anslinger's word to make it scary. Has been legal in Oregon for a while, and that's, I mean, I don't care, but that's a, oh man, you go to Oregon, get some pot, man. Well, they recently passed a law here, a bill here, where pretty much everything is now, I didn't know this was going to come up. I probably should have expected this. I don't know exactly how the law reads, but right now the addiction in Oregon for things like, now meth has been sort of infamous for meth, but now fentanyl and other things that are demonstrably terrible. And so that's legal. Pot is legal as long as you are a favored producer. If you aren't a favored producer, then your county's tax dollars go to fund some sheriff who's going to go with a whole bunch of other sheriffs so they're going to go to this place, tear up all your plants, burn your plants, or do something to them, write you a ticket and do all those other things, put you out of business because you wanted a preferred pot grower. And well, this is really stupid. And it happens a lot. I see it in my feed all the time. And if it was the difference between legalized versus decriminalized, then all these other people could grow their stuff. And the arguments for support, well, they're using water they're not paying for. How do you know that? I mean, it's just straw man kinds of arguments about, well, the state was right. Good job, guys. No part of that makes sense to me that it's a good job. And I recognize that there's unintended, unforeseen consequences for that. Well, they can poison people. Well, think about that. What kind of business sense does it make to sell a product to your customer who's not going to come back and get more? It's not a very insightful business plan to kill everybody and then not have anybody to buy. So,
Right. And what's happening, you know, and has been happening throughout the U.S. at epidemic levels is poisoning with fentanyl. And that's because of prohibition, right? I mean, a lot of these, you know, fentanyl overdoses are like, you know, they're people trying to take pharmaceutical pills that they're getting from their dealer, you know, that are, you know, that come from Mexico or come from China or whatever, and are laced with levels of fentanyl that are lethal. And the reason that's happening is because of prohibition.
Now, I recognize also that no part of any of the conversation that involves drug use, drug legalization, drug decriminalization, reforming police, it's not a simple conversation. It's also not a dispassionate conversation. It's not like, what goes best with my blue suit, the black shoes, the brown shoes? It's a very polarizing conversation.
It's brown
to
shoes.
Have.
If it's a blue suit, it's got to be brown shoes.
I agree with that, but someone's going to say, no. Well, what color is the belt? So the first step is that maybe it's not the first. One of the first steps is having the conversation. The second part is finding a way to have it with some sense of civility and not just throw your hands up and keep with the status quo, because I don't think the status quo is particularly functional. And now we're going to get into – I'm not sure how much your interviews informed you on this, but it's recently been confirmed, although I think lots of people have suspected for a while, that George Soros and probably other people with his resources, but much more anonymous, have been, by phrase, pimping the system, putting cash into small elections for DAs that George favors. And I'm going to say that I think George favors chaos over order, and I think he's getting it. So in a system that is supposed to be a closed shop, we have this outside player, probably more, who are sort of nibbling at the edges, getting the impact that he wants. That sounds like a really big deal. And maybe you don't care about that because maybe that's, I'm in favor of that. You're only in favor because you like the result. But the principle is that something you can't control is impacting something that's going to impact you, and you'll hate it as soon as you're caught up in it. So big question, not an easy answer. What do you do about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with you on Soros. I mean, first of all, I do think Soros and other foreign parties are really manipulating and have been for a long time manipulating elections in this country in order to get, you know, the results that they're looking for, which I think really is instability. I think that in order to get and it's not really a conspiracy anymore that these elites want a world government. It's out in the open. You read the WEF papers. They're talking about it openly. They want a world government. This is what they want to happen. They want a CBDC, central bank digital currency, so they're able to have full control of the money supply, and then through that CBDC, be able to control behaviors and social credit and all of those different things. So what do we do about it? That's the million-dollar question, right? I mean, you know, I think there's several different things that we can do at a personal level and also politically. So let's talk politics first. So what can we do politically to try to fight back? I mean, one thing is calling it out. Because oftentimes the media is not talking about this. So it just, you know, calling it out to your friends and, you know, not just on Twitter, but, you know, being able to have a conversation, especially if you live in one of these areas where there is a Soros prosecutor who has been put in place. Just talking through the different things that they're doing and, you know, essentially making the point that they are promoting chaos in the city in which you reside. To fight back against it, I think some of these cities like Chicago or New York City or LA or San Francisco, I think they're basically they're lost. I mean, at this point, I don't know how they're going to turn around. I would advise people to get out of those cities. I don't see them getting better. How much worse will they get? I don't know. How quickly will it happen? I have no idea. I'm not going to predict that. But I mean, the way things have gotten with homelessness and, you know, just open air drug markets and things like that, it's not a good place if you're trying to raise children, of course, in those environments. So I would just say, number one, take ownership and vote with your feet and get out of those areas. Get to an area where you feel safe and then get involved in the politics locally. I'm not saying you have to run for office, but, you know, get to understand the candidates who align with what you believe in, Republican or Democrat, Libertarian. Libertarians probably aren't going to win. Maybe at the local level, maybe you can win an office here or there with a with a Libertarian. But for the most part, it's probably going to be a local Republican candidate that is going to align most with your values at the local level. They're not going to align. If you're a Libertarian, they're not going to align 100%, but it's probably going to be the closest fit. And I mean, just for an example, where I live just outside of Pittsburgh in the suburbs, here we had a school board primary, this past week. And I had been a registered Libertarian since whenever I guess Gary Johnson ran for president. I think that's when I first switched over and voted. Prior to that, I was a Ron Paul Republican. I voted in the primaries for Ron Paul. But I actually switched my registration to Republican in order to vote in the primary for the school board race in the township that I live. Because, you know, just looking at the candidates, there's no Libertarians running. It's just Republicans and Democrats. I wanted to make sure the five candidates who align most with what I believe and, you know, got at least one vote. And the more localized the politics, the smaller the number amount of people voting. It's just simple math. The bigger impact your vote has the potential of having. So I would say the most, if we talk about politics and changing this, the most important thing you can do is get involved in your local politics. It's probably not going to be, if you are a Libertarian, it's probably not going to be with the Libertarian Party. It might be. Maybe you can win a race here or there, depending where you are and how strong your local Libertarian Party is. Otherwise, get involved with the local Republican Party. Try to influence them. Try to influence the candidates. Run for office, maybe. And change things locally. As you expand out from there to, you know, congressional and statewide candidates and finally federal candidates, the less influence, the less your vote really matters, and the less you're going to be able to change things. I mean, there's at this point, the president, I don't know how much the president really impacts our daily lives on a day-to-day basis. Really, Joe Biden, maybe more so than any president I can remember, probably had more of an impact on my personal life just because of the regulations coming down through the CDC and the FDA with Anthony Fauci with COVID were impacting people having jobs and having to take a pharmaceutical in order to have a job. So that was direct impact there. But over the long term, how much impact does a president have on your life? Probably not a ton. So I would say focus locally, get involved locally. And then the second part would be start taking care of yourself, your family, start getting some, a safety net for yourself. And, growing a garden, a lot of people will go to that as a thing you should do. And we have a garden in our house. I mean, it's nice to get some vegetables, fresh vegetables, and we grow herbs and all that stuff. And I hunt and, I try to at least get one deer every hunting season. And that's nice. A few years ago, my dad got an elk, shared some with us. That was awesome. That's great. It's great to have, those food sources, but not everyone's going to have those, those opportunities. Some people live in areas where that's not really feasible. Plan, can some food, get the, whatever the 90 day food emergency supply in case, our power grid goes down. I think for a long time we thought, just crazy preppers do that. But I mean, things can escalate quickly. So I would encourage people to be ready for anything at this point in time, because literally they shut the world down for almost 2 years. They'll do anything.
They will do anything. You mentioned CBDC, and I saw, so there, it sort of ties in. So the whole digital thing, I just saw a tweet. So this is kind of timely, and it may not pan out as the weeks go on from this recording, but Congress, has been talking, and other governments around the world have been talking about instituting, social media police. So this bill is introduced in the Senate to basically make sure that the things that you are writing on social media are approved by the empire, and that is with a capital E. And you can imagine Darth Vader all you want, you can laugh about it, but quite literally, the U.S. is an empire. And way back in 1789, maybe Luther Martin actually used that word to describe what was going to happen if they ratified that dreaded document, you're going to build an empire. Well, how the hell did Luther Martin know that? I don't know the answer to that, but he was freaking smart. Mm-hmm. That's a usurpation of power at an incomprehensible level. And I think the U.S. at this point might even be part of the puppet regime for, this is a conspiracy theory, BlackRock, Vanguard, WEF, who also have a master, maybe a couple. And you can, if you know who the trillionaires are on the planet, that's probably who's running the show. So we're talking about the school board or your local city council, how much impact does that vote have on your digital prison? Because now you don't actually have green pieces of fiat currency to go with your fiat drugs and your fake arrest. You have digits, which the government can take away. Oh, sorry. You know what, Mr. Automat? You've had a lot of ice cream this month. I'm sorry. You cannot buy that. That never happened. What do you mean? It never happened? I told you can't work without a shot. Of course it'll happen.
It won't be the ice cream. It'll be the steak. You don't need more than one
right
steak
about
a
that.
Month.
You're right. Have more sugar, but you may not have the animal.
All the ice cream you want. Have all the. In fact, the more ice cream you get, we'll give you more money if you have more ice cream.
Right, because we have these really fine pharmaceuticals just for that.
Exactly.
Good point.
I try not to be black-pilled because I do think ultimately we will win.
Before you explain, somebody doesn't know. So what the hell did he just say? What does black pill mean?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. This goes back to the Matrix movie, Keanu Reeves, and, take the red pill or the red pill or the blue pill. The blue pill, essentially you go back into your dream and you think everything's great. You take the red pill and everything is revealed to you for what it is. So it started with red pilled, blue pilled. Red pilled people understand what's happening. They understand the government is corrupt. They understand, a lot of these conspiracy theories that keep coming true, are real government programs that are happening. And then they've kind of added on to it. I forget who came up with the black pill, white pill, but the black pill is having a pessimistic attitude on the future, and the white pill is having an optimistic attitude on the future. And, I would say short term, the next 3 to 5 years, maybe even 10 years. I don't know. I am pretty black pilled on how bad things will get in this country. I think regardless of what happens the next presidential election, I don't even think that matters, but I do think the Democrats will win, whoever the candidate is, be it dementia laden Joe Biden, or even if Donald Trump wins, he's not going to change a freaking thing. He's just looking out for himself. Although one thing he might do, he might end the war in Ukraine, which at least that would stop some people from dying, which would be nice. But I don't necessarily believe him that he would do that. But if he did, that would be great. But just to continue on the white pill aspect of it, I do think ultimately we will win, just because this is just not sustainable what they are doing. And I think the human race, I think we just have too many individuals with high characters and morals, and that are extremely creative individuals who are going to be able to overcome this. And I mean, we're seeing it happen to a degree. No matter what you think of someone like an Elon Musk, and I go back and forth on Elon Musk. I think right now he's an ally. Long term, he might not be, somebody that's in our corner. He might be trying to put, a Neuralink in each of our brains. I'm not sure. But I think right now with Elon Musk at Twitter, favoring free speech, I think that's someone who is our ally that, sure. Yes, I will support Elon Musk in what he's doing there. His recent hire for CEO, of course, some WEF ties there. I'm not sure what that deal is, but we'll just have to wait and see how that shakes out. When it comes to, so you were talking about BlackRock and Vanguard and, alluding to ESG and how, essentially those two in like mega doesn't even do justice the amount of wealth they control. It's just, it's unthinkable the amount of companies that they essentially control, the amount of money they have flowing through their accounts is just, it's really hard to even imagine, hard to even put into words. And I think we kind of see that with the way that this ESG thing is rolling out with these DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives, how these corporations are just pushing things down our throats that nobody wants. I mean, we saw what happened with Bud Light. Bud Light had that trans TikTok star do a commercial, not a commercial, whatever. It was she did a video on her feed or his feed, whatever, for Bud Light. And they had their face on a can of Bud Light. And it's totally tanked their sales for the past, you know, 6 weeks. They've been down like 20% every week, maybe more than that. And people look at that and they go, well, this is a great, this is the market reaction, the market's speaking. And yeah, sure, that's good. The market is speaking. But I think like we have to look a little deeper than that and start to realize that they're making these calls and these corporations are not responding to consumers. They are doing the bidding of the BlackRock and Vanguard and whoever controls them. That's where these commercials come from. You know, people can like speculate, this commercial, are they trying to reach out to the LGBTQ community? No, they're not. This is just a part of an ESG agenda, economic social governance, just being pushed down from the BlackRocks and Vanguards of the world. And there's going to be more and more of it shoved down our throat. I mean, we see it almost every corporation is picking up this LGBTQ flag and just shoving it down our throat. And June's, you know, coming. What's that?
June's coming.
Yeah. And I'm not anti-LGBTQ. You know, you're a consenting adult, do what you want. I'm not here to tell you how to live your life or what you can do, what you can do in your own house, your own bedroom, whatever. But where I have the biggest problem with it is just the involvement with children and the pushing on trying to, you know, trying to be around children with it. That part just makes me sick. And it's like, it's everywhere. And it's major corporations doing it. It's really something to watch. So why am I white-pilled? I said at the beginning, I think there is a concern. I just interviewed Doug Stewart on my show, which will be out this, I'm not sure when this show's coming out. It'll be out Monday. We're recording this on Friday, May 19th. It'll be out next Monday. And Doug is, he's the CEO of the Christian Libertarian Institute. And we were talking about this topic. We were talking about the woke religion and we were talking about ESG and really how does this play out? And I was telling him my biggest fear is not what's happening with this woke religion. My biggest fear is the pendulum swinging back. What happens? The right's response to this. And I think we have to be very, very careful with that. And even as libertarians, we have to be careful how we respond to what's happening. We don't want to be responding with hatred and responding, calling everybody insane who's pushing this message. There could be good people who are caught up in this, think they're doing the right thing, who think they're standing up for individuals. When in reality, they're just doing the bidding of these, the Black Rocks and the Vanguards of the world.
And through all of this, it hasn't gotten one bit less complicated.
No.
Even with the hot summer coming, dinner still needs to get on the table. Cooking for comfort does have easy to make recipes for those hot summer days. Pick up a copy of Cooking for Comfort on Amazon or off the blog post, culinarylibertarian.com/cooking for comfort. All right, I want to move on since we're running out of time here. They call this being the other guest, the quick fire part of the show. Of the five flavors, bitter, salty, sweet, sour, or umami, which one's your favorite?
Well, it depends what I'm pairing it with. We'll say, so I mean, my favorite thing to eat is steak. And one of my favorite things to season a steak with is umami. So I'll go with umami.
All right. What's your favorite food? I think you just answered that.
I'll say something else. So I do love steak. My favorite food, it really changes frequently. It kind of depends what I'm really liking at the time. I would say all time, probably one of my favorite meals has to be my mom's spaghetti and meatballs. Just hard to beat. I would say that's my favorite food.
What's your least favorite food?
This is easy. Coconut. I cannot stand coconut. I don't understand the infatuation with putting it in all kinds of desserts. It tastes like garbage and the texture is terrible. So I'm very anti-coconut.
What sound do you love?
Sound do I love? Great question. I love the sound of my daughter's laughter. I think that's my favorite sound.
What sound do you hate?
Oh man, that's tough. I don't like the sound of cable news telecasts. the bickering back and forth, all squeezed in to a 2-minute time segment.
It's theater, yeah. What gets you excited?
What gets me excited is talking to other like-minded people, like yourself, talking about ideas, talking about food, talking about liberty, talking about faith, and talking about, you know, freedom, talking about our path forward, where we see ourselves going in the future.
What turns you off?
What turns me off is negativity, really. Which is kind of ironic because I think some of the show we were kind of negative during the show. But you know, yeah, I think someone who is always negative, always down, that's a turn off to me.
What's your favorite color?
Favorite color is orange.
If you could cook for anyone ever, who would that be?
Johnny Cash.
I like that answer. What's your favorite food indulgence?
I would have to go, you know, I do like ice cream, but I rarely ever eat it. And it's gotten to the point that the only one kind of ice cream, and that is ice cream from, you're not going to like this, but from the Penn State Creamery, which is the greatest creamery in all of the land. So that's my indulgence.
I will accept that answer only because I'm sure the Penn State Creamery is fantastic. And Michigan State has a School of Agriculture, and I don't know if they make ice cream with the cows that are there, but they probably do. Mm-hmm. And I never had it, but I went there. Gosh, well, long time ago. And they had, and I'm sure not just there, but they had, because they were doing agricultural science, they wanted to learn about how cows digest food. So they put a window in the cow's stomach, and that was kind of interesting. In the second and a half, I looked in. I don't remember seeing particularly very much, but I thought it was interesting. So, yes, I will accept. I will accept something positive out of Penn State. Ice cream will do it. Normally, we would have a second part, but we're running out of time, and I don't want to make it late. What would you make for Johnny Cash?
Oh man, damn. I don't know. What would Johnny Cash like? I think Johnny Cash would like something simple, yet with flavor. So I would say I'd make a steak seasoned with umami, some nice roasted red potatoes, and with a side of green beans.
I think your assessment of his preference is probably right, and I don't have no way of knowing this, but but how he, in the interviews, not very many, I'm not a Johnny Cash expert in any way, shape, or form, but I think simple, done well, would be what he would prefer. And I think that probably applies to a great many people. And some people would, I want the most complex. simple is actually harder to do.
Yeah.
As the guy who's cooked the extremely complex and the very simple, there's no place to hide. You make a mistake in the simple, and it's just there. It's for everyone to see. You can hide mistakes in the really complicated stuff. But I think that's a very good meal. And I don't know if Johnny was a drinker, but a nice cold beer would be good with that.
Yeah, well, I know at one point in his life, I don't think at the end of his life he was drinking anymore, but he definitely used to be a drinker.
Yeah, so. I think maybe a little bit on the too much side. How can people follow you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at John Odermatt. That's JohnOdermatt. Same handle for Instagram, or our Lions of Liberty handle, both on Twitter and Instagram, is at Lions of Liberty. Of course, you can go to our webpage, lionsofliberty.com. Post our shows there, but people don't really go to web pages anymore. So you can just search for the Lions of Liberty Podcast Network. We're on all major podcast platforms. My show is called Finding Freedom. That is every Monday. We have another show on Wednesday hosted by Brian McWilliams called Mean Age Daydream. And then on Fridays, we have a new show called Meme Wars, where we talk about funny memes and have a good time.
I wanted to ask you one follow-up question about your mom's spaghetti meatballs. Now, Odermatt does not sound to me particularly Italian. Was your mother Italian, or just really made a good spaghetti meatball dish?
She's not Italian. Odermatt is Swiss, which is why I love cheese so much. I think it's just in my blood. But she's not Italian. And honestly, her mother, my grandmother on that side, was not a very good cook, which is what led my mother to becoming a good cook, because at a very early age, she became the cook in the family. And I'm honestly not sure where she got the recipe from, but yeah, of course, if you compare it to, you know, maybe an authentic Italian grandma, it might not beat that. But for growing up in Pittsburgh and being a self-taught cook like my mom, it's pretty good.
There's a tremendous amount of value to be had in the memory and all that goes with it over anyone's one particular dish. And even if by some sort of objective measure, some nana in Sicily, well, probably not Sicily, northern Italy made a really good Tuscan. Tuscany would make a good meatball, spaghetti meatball. Yeah, maybe in some contest it would win, but there's still something to be said for all that went into that childhood experience. And there's a tremendous amount of actual real value that I can't get it from you, but you have, and some by too, and the listener of whatever the thing is. There's a lot to that. And my mother wasn't an amazing cook, but she did some really great. And she was like, wow, I hope she makes that thing again. There was just a few things that was like, I would love to get them again. I can't, but I respect very much that your mom's spaghetti meatballs has that huge place in your life, and that's very important. I like that.
Yeah, well, there's the sentimental value like you're talking about. Where sometimes when you have a bite of it, you think back to your childhood sitting around that table. You have your family there, it's almost like teleporting you back in time for just a moment.
That's the Proustian moment with the Madeleines, and in the Remy, the cooking, the Disney cooking movie with the rat and the kid. That was at the very end. Ego has the ratatouille.
Ratatouille?
Yeah, that's the movie.
Yeah.
When Ego, the food critic, eats the ratatouille, and you see, boom, he's 4 years old at mama's kitchen.
Yeah.
The power of food to transport you through time and place is, I think, highly undervalued. It's extraordinarily a powerful moment.
I think some people have a gift in that. My wife, for one, my wife's an excellent cook as well. And she has this weird thing where she has memories that can be triggered by smells based on something that she smells. Awesome. It'll take her back to a memory. And I do wonder if people, especially people who are, you know, very, you know, very inclined to be, you know, good chefs or good home cooks or whatever. I wonder if that's sort of a common trait in that area.
That's a fascinating question. I've never thought that question before, but that, wow, that's a good question. I don't know. I'll see if it may take a while to get any kind of conclusion to that.
You have to think about it. When I have you on my show, I can ask you that question. I'll give you some time to think about it.
Okay. Well, the other thing, and I know we're pushing it here. And here's the thing I want to wonder about that. So the people who have the power to smell the thing and have the memory, do they dream in video and audio and color? Because I know people who dream in still pictures, black and white. Which never occurred to me because I am full color audio visual. Dreams are like movies with sound. Really? Yeah. And I didn't know that wasn't normal.
Yeah, my dreams are, yeah. I rarely remember my dreams, for one. And when I do, it's just like, it's like chaos. It's just like, I don't know, can't even explain it. But yeah, my wife will tell me her dreams, like detail by detail. Then this happened. I'm like, what the heck? So yeah, I do. That's interesting.
Wow.
We might have uncovered something here.
I don't know. This is a lot of fun. All right. Well, John, thank you very much for your time today. You're this afternoon for you. Don't reveal this, but if you're anywhere near Squirrel Hill, if that French pastry shop is still there with the Madeleines, oh, really, you owe it to us. If you've never been there, it's worth finding. It is spectacular.
I haven't been there. I will check it out.
They're amazing.
It's not close, but it's not, I mean, it's not that far.
You know, Squirrel Hill is 3 blocks, so it's not that big. Yeah. But oh my God. It is the best French pastry I've ever had.
Really? Wow.
They're that good. They're amazing. Worth finding. Good trip into town.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add a link to the Lions of Liberty webpage, which has a link to Finding Freedom, John's current podcast. We had a time restriction, so there is no chef's table for this episode. There are plenty of chef tables from previous guests on the Patreon that are for patrons. Find the support link to become a patron on the show notes page. I spoke with the person narrating the audio version of 50 Things to Know About Being a Chef. She had a few questions about the pronunciation of a couple of names, and that made perfect sense. She told me that of the 60-some books she's narrated, this one is in her top three. I was pretty pleased with that. I don't know when the audiobook will be available. The physical or digital books are available at culinarylibertarian.com/50chefthings. That's all one phrase. Have a great week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.
I've heard the audio's the audio is a little cleaner with Zencastr though, so maybe that's a.
I don't have any complaints about the audio. The audio is fantastic. Yeah. There's one other one, Riverside, that I don't think is free at all, and I like free is good. It's my favorite price. So, but anyway, that's. Another story. So thank you for making time out of me today. Sure. I'm going to overlook that shirt you're wearing. Go blue, by the way. And now you know why.
There you go.
So I want to say that I saw Lions of Liberty. I said, oh my God, Patrick Henry. Not so much. So
close.
Yeah. But Penn State, I mean, come on. We can overlook that. I actually know people in Ohio who I'm quite fond of. So
really?
Yes. Wow. And she doesn't. She understands it because you can't live in Ohio and not know about the game. But she doesn't really care. She's a homesteader.
Yeah. I like if Penn State's not playing, obviously Michigan or Ohio State, I'll normally root for them against, you know, I'll root for the Big Ten to win. So if Michigan or Ohio State's playing in a bowl game or the playoff, I'll root for the Big Ten.
But I will never, ever, even if it's Purdue, I will never root for Ohio State. It cannot happen.
Although I will say I did laugh very, very hard when they missed that field goal right when it struck midnight last year. I did enjoy that. That was funny.
Anytime. Yes. Well, humor is a good thing to have. All right. I hope we have a lot to go through here. And I have a few parts at the end. I do all the preamble and the wrong thing. Post content stuff later. So we're going to just kind of dive in here.